Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound mixers, VFX gurus, composers, stunt coordinators, stuntmen, you name it, we talk to them. And you all know how much I love talking. Well, this week on Behind the Lens, I'm very excited about this show. Because we're going from the Old West down into the deep blue or not so blue sea, discussing two wonderful films with two terrific filmmakers, Last Breath and director Alex Parkinson, and Gunslingers with writer, director, editor Brian Skiba. First up, I'm going to take a listen to my exclusive interview with director Alex Parkinson talking about Last Breath. Currently in theaters and on VOD, Last Breath is a heart-pounding film that follows seasoned deep-sea divers as they battle the raging elements to rescue their crewmate who is trapped hundreds of feet below the ocean surface. This is based on a true story of events that occurred in 2012, as well as a 2019 documentary that Alex also did before deciding to make the narrative feature that we're going to talk about today. This is an electrifying story about teamwork, resilience, a race against time to do the impossible, and dare I say it without being spoilery, do you believe in miracles? Last Breath is compelling, riveting, nerve-wracking. There's nail-biting tension. The emotional tonal bandwidth is through the roof. Performances are first rate. Woody Harrelson, Simu Liu, Finn Cole, Cliff Curtis, just to name a few. Personally, I love Simu Liu's character development and arc as Dave. And Woody Harrelson is just fantastic with this wonderful passion and a kind of freewheeling yet loving paternal feeling towards his younger dive mates who he kind of oversees. The production design is through the roof with a diving bell that is built. You can look at original photos of the original bell that they go down in to service what these divers do. They actually go down to the sea to service the oil rigs and gas rigs. In this particular instance, this incident involved a rig in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland in very rough and raging waters, and as luck would have it, during a storm. And this is where the cinematography is so key and so important in tandem with Tanya Goading's editing. As I started to say, the production design with the diving bell, the bridge of the ship, and the compression tube housing that these divers have to live in before and after to acclimate their bodies to the shift in pressure. It looks a lot like, it's very cool, it looks a lot like those early quarantine depressurization tanks, housings, trailers that NASA built for the early astronauts, especially the early Apollo astronauts after they went to the moon. And who knows what kind of moon germs could have come back. But the editing in tandem with the cinematography and Nick Remy Matthews is the cinematographer. You know his work from Hotel Mumbai, Gangs of London, Bagman. He does a wonderful job, but the real standout cinematography comes from the man who I think is possibly the best underwater cinematographer in the business today. That is Ian Seabrook. You know a lot of Ian's work from Indiana Jones, the final Indiana Jones, Jungle Cruise, The Rescue that he did with Jimmy Chin. Ian's work is exemplary here. absolutely exemplary. And then you get Tanya's editing that is crisp and sharp and well-paced, and it builds tension to the point of being almost explosive. And much of the tension in the film is subconsciously enhanced or increased with cuts between the raging stormy seas above and the violent movements of the ship with the what appears to be somewhat calm on the ocean floor. It's really interesting to watch and to see this. So Tanya has done a wonderful job and melding that with Nick's cinematographic work and Ian's. It's not often you get to speak with a filmmaker who has made a documentary and then adapted it into a narrative feature, but that's exactly what Alex has done with Last Breath. So now, in this exclusive interview, which we did last week, Alex talks about the transition from his 2012 2019 documentary to the 2025 narrative film, emphasizing the experiential and emotional depth he wanted to achieve in this feature. He highlights the importance of cinematic visuals, particularly the underwater scenes shot in real seawater. This is salt water that they shot in a tank, a huge tank that is in Malta. I believe this is the same tank that Ridley Scott just used for Gladiator 2. And of course, salt water, seawater, has a different buoyancy than fresh water. And it also has different texture to it, with salt and with other little microscopic things that are floating around. So it was very important to use salt water for filling that tank and shooting this film. Alex highlights the importance of cinematic visuals, particularly those underwater scenes, not to mention the use of authentic sounds. The sound design of the sound underwater and the comms as you're talking underwater, the divers are talking to each other and to the surface. Plus the surface sounds of a ship that you think is going to capsize at any moment. It's really fabulous to make this a sensory experience and, as Alex wanted, experiential. And it all serves to enhance the story's tension. We talk about the performances and break down the authenticity that Alex wanted to achieve here and his decision to include real footage from the 2012 event, which showcases the real-life camaraderie of the divers, Duncan, Dave, and Chris, and which the actors, which Woody and Simu and Finn, then bring to life so vividly on screen. It's amazing. It's amazing to see the similarities in the camaraderie. And on film, it never feels forced. It feels natural. Everything. It's a wonderful film. It's an interesting interview. So I'm going to shut up and let you take a listen to my chat with director Alex Parkinson talking Last Breath. Hey, Alex.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Very, very pleased to be speaking with you today. I saw your documentary back in 2019.
Oh, really? Right. Wow. Okay. Yes. Great.
And I remembered when this happened back in 2012.
Okay.
Because I'm such a news junkie about some things, and this was so fascinating. And I remembered that. Then when I saw your doc, 7 years later or whatever, I kept thinking, wow, I'm surprised nobody has made this into a movie yet. And lo and behold, here we are now in 2025, and you have done just that yourself.
Yes, indeed, yes. So it's been quite a journey.
I love how you have taken the doc and moved it into narrative form. it really lets you flesh out each of these men, each of these characters, and let us see their relationship, their dynamics, and learn something about them. And that's something you don't see in the documentary. You didn't get in newspaper and news media reports in 2012. I love how you have been able to do that by making the narrative.
Because, I mean, that's the great sort of thing about being able to do the feature, the narrative version, is because with the documentary, as you would have seen, it's lots of talking heads. Which is great, and that's the form of the documentary. They're telling you what to think and what they're doing and how things work and all that kind of stuff. But then to try and tell the story without that, then what it makes it is much more experiential, and the characters and emotional arcs of the characters and their intra-relationships really start to come to the fore. And it's why I always see it as a sort of a companion piece.
It's a perfect double feature. I have to tell you, Alex, it's a perfect double feature. To watch that. But you're absolutely right, and you have achieved this, because the result that you get, it's compelling, it's riveting, it is beyond nerve-wracking, nail-biting tension. And the emotional tonal bandwidth, just on its own, is through the roof. Then when you look at and you meld the visual tonal bandwidth, which supports the emotional tonal bandwidth, and vice versa, everything comes together so perfectly. I'm curious how you embarked on this when you decided that, okay, because you have done the documentary, you have seen original footage, you have seen the boat, you have met Duncan, Dave, and Chris, and you know the players. How do you then approach this to turn it into a narrative feature versus a clinical documentary?
Well, what I touched upon just a second ago, my main guiding light with this was about sort of to explore the characters more.
Right.
And to get more about their emotional journey, and also to make it for the audience as well, to make it much more experiential. But it's all about that cinematic experience. And also for the documentary, I mean, I love the documentary, and obviously I would say that, but documentaries just don't have a bigger audience as feature films.
Right.
So it's a great chance as well to tell this incredible story on a bigger scope and scale, and also to a bigger audience. As well.
Your visuals are so important here because they are very cinematic. Nick, your cinematographer, Nick does an amazing job, as well as, I think, my favorite underwater cinematographer of all time, Ian Seabrook.
Amazing.
Oh, Ian is just, he is beyond reproach with what he does. But I love what we see, the perspectives that we get. Although we have underwater footage from the documentary, and you even intersperse some of that here and in the end credits.
Yes.
Seeing this now in narrative form, where you have the underwater station, it is built, it is there, you have lighting, and it's in color, which adds a whole, when you look at things in color versus black and white, it's a whole different dimension. So it makes it.
Having Ian doing the underwater work with just the way he moves through the water and everything else. I mean, there's everything else beyond that, but he's so good at moving in the water, getting those shots and feeling what's going on. But also he and his team as well about lighting it. So I was so keen. Because the black and white footage you were talking about from the documentary, which are bits of it are in the feature as well, it has that sense of claustrophobia and sheer terror behind it because of the very nature of how it looks. And what I wanted to do with the underwater work that Ian was doing was to have this sort of the manifold, the big structure which most of the action, underwater action, happens on, is to have this sort of, it's surrounded by this darkness.
Yeah.
This ever looming presence of the threat and danger of what is out there. Because obviously we know the ocean is endless, and I could have gone down the route of which has been done in films before, where you want to see that going to distance, you want to feel that depth to it, and you do that through CG or whatever to do that. But I stayed clear of that because I wanted to keep it as claustrophobic and feeling as dangerous as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Make it match with those CCTV footage which you've seen before in the documentary, that sense of terror and
yes.
inherent danger to the environment.
After I saw Last Breath, I actually, in my thoughts that I sent to the publicist of the film, and I even said that, you know, the negative space, I love negative space, and that's what the blackness is. It's negative space. We see and feel, it's chillingly textured, the murkiness, and that makes it scary as hell. And with that light, the lighting and the yellow of the manifold, yellow, it's almost, you know, caution, a metaphor for caution. As if you're driving your car on the street and the yellow caution light comes on, the traffic signal.
I mean, it has that sort of subconscious mm-hmm. context to it.
Yes.
But also in reality, those structures are that yellow.
Yeah.
Because they cut through what's there. It's to do with how light works with water as well. Sorry, I cut you off
there. Oh, no, that's fine. Now, I know you shot this in Malta in that incredible tank that they have there, but you filled it with seawater, did you not?
Yes, that's right, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the default thing they fill it with anyway. I mean, you can filter it or you can do it fresh water, but the seawater was really good because it just inherently has that particulate still,
yeah.
little bit to it, which give it a life.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as you say, it's got that sort of murkiness to it as well, which comes and goes, which we had to manage very carefully, because if we didn't, we would have had a complete murk out, as it were. but it was trying to get that balance right, where you could feel that density of water, which would have been really hard to do in CG, if not
yeah.
impossible to do.
Yeah.
It has that life to it, which immediately puts you in that situation.
Yeah, that really excited me before I even saw the film, knowing that you did not CGI this.
No.
That you did. You shot underwater in a huge
yeah.
tank. And I'm so happy you used this salt water, because salt water also has a different buoyancy when things are moving in it than fresh water
yeah.
does. So even down to that minutia of detail, you really steep us in authenticity and immerse us in this experience. So we are there with Dave and Chris.
Yeah, I mean, that was my whole intent from the very outset, was to do that. Because also, that's the interesting thing about the difference between the documentary and the feature, is that with the documentary, there's always going to be a distance between the story and the audience. You're
right.
not really fully immersed in it. You're going to follow the arc of a story, but you're not going to be completely pulled along by it, because you are, as I said earlier, you're always going to be listening to people telling you what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then to take that and then do it in feature form, where the whole point is to completely immerse the audience and make an experiential thing, then authenticity is at the root of that, without doubt. For me, anyway, with this particular story. So it even goes down to filming in the saturation chambers, for example,
mm-hmm.
where I wanted the proportions to be accurate to how they are in real life. And then also, I mean, Grant Montgomery, the production designer, did a fantastic job, and he built all these flyaway walls as well. But then when it came to it, I didn't want to use them at all, because I wanted the camera to be forced into those angles, which it would have been if I was filming it as a documentary, to keep it within that authentic world you're in. And I think these are all things that an audience pick up subconsciously most of the time. And it just makes you feel as though you're watching something for real. And what I loved about it was the first batch of dailies I watched. So the first shoot day was with Finn, I keep on getting their real names, the character names.
Yeah, Finn Cole, yeah.
Yes, so it's Finn, Simu and Woody in the saturation chamber, and watching the dailies of that, I knew that it felt very different from most films I've seen, because you're watching Hollywood actors in a very real feeling situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had this really interesting energy and feel to it, which I think is then borne out throughout the whole film.
I love the design of that saturation chamber. I love the claustrophobic nature of it. And yeah, and that one, you know, with Nick, since that was not underwater, Nick was responsible for this. And the way that we get the overhead looking down to the open, and it's like it's an overhead slightly Dutch to the side. So we really get to see how tiny and how little room there is to navigate, especially when you've got Woody's character of Duncan, and he's the one feeding the lines down to Dave and Chris. And they one wrong step, and he's going through the hole underwater.
Yeah, absolutely. And he could have been pulled through. In reality, he could have been pulled through very easily. So, I mean, they're all in their own way. They have their own elements of peril.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the point. They were putting themselves on the line to go back and hope beyond hope rescue a still living person.
Yeah. And of course, Grant's production design extends beyond the saturation chamber to the ship. The bridge of the ship is...
Yes, it was a very uncanny feeling for me. Because obviously I've spent a lot of time on the real ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very uncanny feeling stepping onto that set for the first time when it's complete and feeling, wow, it really took me back to actually being on the real ship. It was just a phenomenal job you did. It was really incredible.
Yeah, the detail and all. Just absolutely outstanding. And then here again, you put actors into that space that really embody the characters. I mean, Cliff Curtis, he can do no wrong anywhere, in my opinion, is Captain Jensen. And then you've got Mark Bonner as our poor diving supervisor, who is a nervous wreck. And Myanna Burring is Hannah. I love the dynamic between her and Cliff's character.
Yeah, I mean, they're all such phenomenal actors as well, as we all know. But it was really interesting, that whole bridge situation as well, like the dynamics between all of them, because obviously they're going through a whole different thing from Dave and Duncan and Chris as well. And it's about keeping the trajectory of the tension up, and about what they had to do, and about these calculated risks they were taking, such as Cliff's character taking over manual control of the ship, and Myanna helping out, the first officer helping out with that. So I thought it was phenomenal acting on all their parts, but it's really interesting texturally and dramatically about how to balance that with the stuff going on underwater as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, did you, obviously that, you know, was a soundstage, I'm guessing, for the bridge of the ship. Did you shoot that on gimbals to get the movement of the ship?
Yes, it was shot on a rocker.
So, okay.
So it went side to side by 15 degrees either side. So we had that. And interesting to say soundstage, it wasn't actually, we built a soundstage for it in a working shipyard warehouse.
Ooh, nice.
Down in the docks in Malta, and we built the soundstage down there. So we built the rocker, and then there's this huge double curtain tent we built around it for the sound.
Wow. I love that. I just thought that, and then the way that Tanya has cut it in the editing, and really giving, we see all the rocking, we see people rocking with due to the weather and the waves outside, and then we've got cuts that actually show us the pitching of the boat. This is beyond anything anyone has seen with Poseidon Adventures or anything like that. This is really rocking and rolling out there. I kept waiting for the ship to roll over.
Well, that would have been a whole other story if it had.
Yeah, it certainly would. But, you know, when it comes to the casting, it's like Woody, Simu, and Finn. This is a great great showcase for Finn. But Woody, this is not a character I would have expected him in. But he is just so commanding. Fatherly and fun, caring. And then Simu, to watch his character arc. That's where his character of Dave has a great emotional arc.
I mean, I think Dave's arc is the most interesting.
Yes.
I think he goes on the biggest journey in a way, and about how to, he sort of embodies that idea of, like, you can't do, no person is devoid of other people around them, you know. You've got to enjoy and, you know, you have family and love and all that kind of stuff, and he kind of compartmentalizes it. That's the whole point about the beginning of him going in and saying, once that door closes, that's it. You only focus on the job. And he is like that in real life to some degree, but not as sort of as starkly as that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about his journey, about understanding and appreciating, not compartmentalizing your life. And I think that's a really enjoyable journey to watch him go on, to the point of where he looks at the photo of his daughters. It's a really powerful moment, I think, which ties it up really nicely.
The way the camera holds on that frame for just a few beats, and it's quiet, and you see Simu's, his facial expression. And it's like you can feel the burden, the onus, and the of here I am and I'm not with my child. And it's really incredible to watch. Really wonderful.
Simu's performance was phenomenal throughout. It's a really powerful moment, and it's one which gives me a lump in my throat when I see it. Definitely.
Yeah.
Because one of the sort of underlying themes of the film, which is there, I mean, it's a sub theme rather than one at the forefront, is about this idea about leaving family to work and about what rifts and what ruptures that causes, basically, and about how people deal with that. People deal with that in ways, don't they? And obviously, we all do it in our own way. It's one of those universal truths. We all leave our family at some point, or our loved ones, to go and do work, which we may not want to do, but you have to do it to necessity. And that's part of the subtext of what the film's about.
And that's one of the great things about Woody's performance is Duncan, because here he is, and they're trying to, this will be his last dive. It's like, nope, you got to retire. This is his family. Chris has his fiance that he's going to go back to. Dave has his own family that he will return to. But for Duncan, this is his family.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the feature, definitely.
Yeah.
Because that's what's kind of beautiful about where reality, where art, if I can call it art, art reflects reality, is that the relationship that Duncan, sorry, I'll keep going back to the character name.
That's okay.
The relationship that Woody, Seymour and Finn had on set was very, very similar to what the real people have in reality, where there is this camaraderie and they do get on as well. And you can feel that with how it comes across on screen. Mm-hmm. They do have a respect and camaraderie with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great reflection of what the reality of life was like. And that's partly why the casting was so great for that, because they all, in their own way, when I was speaking to them, they were all my first choice anyway, and it just became very clear that the reason why I was compelled towards them was they all had elements of the real people within them anyway. So it's a really interesting process doing that.
I love that whole, that compartmentalizing and the whole family idea and where they are in life. It really shines here. Now, a big element for me in this film is your sound design. The underwater sound and the chatter on the comms, it is superb. Superb, Alex.
Well, I mean, I can't take credit. I can't take credit for that. But the sound designer, Ben Baird, he did the documentary, for one, so I worked for him on that, and then I just was so, so happy that if timing's worked out, we could do the feature as well. And he just came off the back of doing Conclave to come and do my film.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I mean, Ben is just, he's an absolute joy to work with, and we get on really well, and we're on the same wavelength about sound design, about what the use of it is, and about how to really accentuate what's going on screen with that. And, no, Ben's sound design was, I mean, I absolutely think it's incredible. Well, I would say that, and I'm glad that you agree.
Oh.
I'm getting you do agree. But also a very important mix of that is Paul Leonard Morgan's score as well, because that's all part of that whole side of a film. And I think Paul's music, which he did the documentary as well, and he's done all my films since, actually, his music and Ben's sound design is just incredible.
Yeah.
So powerful.
No, I mean, Paul's scoring is always fantastic. And I love what you've done here with the whole mix, because the score never overpowers the emotion or what we're seeing.
No, and I think that's one of the discussions Paul and I had from the outset, is about, it's there to support and accentuate, not to lead, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really crucial way of how music and image and sound and all that kind of stuff should work together. It should be in concert. It shouldn't be... certainly the sound should, the music shouldn't push it, because then the audience might feel manipulated by what's going on, and it should never be that.
Yeah. And in a film like Last Breath, you don't need score to tell or lead an audience. Just watching what's unfolding, you could have no sound at all and just watch, and the audience is going to feel and experience what is happening with these three men and under the water. You don't need music to tell them.
Sorry, go on.
You don't need music to tell them how to feel.
No, and I think that's really crucial. But you've hit the nail on the head there. That's exactly what it is. It should be, it's in sympathy to it, to build upon what's there emotionally at that point in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that can come from anywhere,
yeah,
really. But yeah, no, I mean, that's crucial, I think, because otherwise I do think that, I mean, audiences are so sophisticated that I think if the music's layering it on, telling you what to feel, I think it would still ring hollow, and I just don't think it'll work.
Yeah, it works fine if you have, like, a B-movie horror film, because you expect it. It would not work fine in something, a dramatic piece like Last Breath. Now, I've got to ask you, how challenging was the editing process here? I mean, the editing, Tanya's editing the film, it's crisp, it's sharp, it's well-paced, it builds tension to the point of being explosive, cutting back and forth with the raging sea, the violent movement of the ship, with underwater, which essentially looks very calm for the most part and belies what's happening on the surface water. But then interspersing everything and hitting those emotional beats, how challenging was this edit?
Well, I mean, all edits have their challenges, obviously, don't they? But it wasn't terribly challenging in the sense of, I mean, the thing is that I started out as an editor, so I'm always looking at things when I'm writing and shooting. I'm always editing in my head anyway and making sure the editor has what they need, primarily, to make the cuts work. And then there was a dialogue during the shoot anyway with Tanya about how things were working, and she was following behind anyway. So there was a dialogue back and forth all the time about that along the way. And then when I was actually in the room with her cutting after the shoot was finished, it was just great. I mean, Tanya's such a phenomenal editor, and it was just great to be able to play with the story with her. So, I mean, my approach to an edit of a film generally is that, which is probably not the normal way, is that I approach it like I'm just literally handed a box of rushes, and I want to make the best film I can from those rushes, rather than being completely beholden to a script. Because I think the thing is, and I can do that with this, because I co-wrote it, so that's an easier thing to do. But the thing is that I think there's a freshness that comes to it if you try to let yourself go with that. Because I think you can as a director, you can, I do find myself doing it, and I really try to stop myself doing it. There may be a certain scene that you really, really like, but you know in your heart of hearts it doesn't quite work within the film, but then you'll try and bend things and twist things and make it work at the detriment to the whole film, rather than just being bold and going, right, you know what, I love the scene, but it's just not working, get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my general... and Tanya was great with me for doing this. I'm very, very brutal in the edit to begin with. I cut it completely down, and I think the first director's cut was under time.
Wow.
So that's what I always do with films, because then I build it up from there, and it's really satisfying to build it up, because it kind of creates a different energy in a way, and it everything's there fighting for its reason to be there. So it kind of has a different dynamic for me about when I'm able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Was it always your intention to include some of the original footage from the dive, from the event?
Which bit you're talking about? The end of the film, or are you talking about Chris on the Manifold?
Chris on the Manifold.
It wasn't my intention. We did shoot all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The ROV we had with Finn on top of the Manifold. But then when it came to the edit, and also it's interesting because when it came to the shoot, because we didn't have the ROV footage shot at that time, the actors were watching the real footage on the monitors.
Okay.
Reacting to that when they were doing it. And then when it came to the edit, it, there's something about the way that the person shot the ROV footage, which is the real footage that is.
Mm-hmm.
So gloriously, it's just capturing it. And it's so impossible for anyone to capture something as though they don't mean to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So the fact that it has this rawness to it, and it's the real thing, it just, I weighed it up in the edit, and it just felt like, you know what, this is more powerful to see the real footage than the stuff we recreated with Finn. And the thing is that most people, if you haven't seen the doc, you would never know. And if you have seen the doc, then most people don't realise unless I mention it to them. So you're one of the few people who have actually picked it out and noticed that. But most people don't at all. So I think it's the right decision to do that, because the power of what Chris was actually going through at that point is really transmitted through that footage.
Mm-hmm. And of course, having real footage of the guys and the dives at the end with the end credits and all, I always love seeing that when we have a narrative that is a true story or inspired by a true story. And it really just, it makes you smile. After all the nerve-wracking moments that we have just witnessed, it really makes you smile to see that they all made it through. They were still friends. They were still working, and they were all happy.
Absolutely. I mean, again, that's another moment in the film when, I mean, I must have watched it, who knows, 100-plus times. But I still well up at that moment when we see, and the music as well, written by a friend of mine, actually.
Oh.
At the end, when you go through to the wedding, it's just so moving, and I love those films when you see the real people. It's a real payoff to see the real people at the end.
And I admit it, I teared up with the wedding footage. I teared up. But they were happy tears.
Yes, of course, yeah. And also the shot of Duncan as well. I just find it absolutely hilarious, the look on his face when Chris is doing his speech. It's priceless. It's just great stuff.
And you see the love that these guys have for each other. I mean, that comes through. And after just seeing the performances that we saw, to see that, and that's the sense you get, and to see that is actual, in real life, the case. That was like the icing on the cake, Alex. The icing on the cake.
Oh, well, that's lovely, yeah. And, well, I mean, that relates to what I was saying earlier, that Woody, Seymour, and Finn, they genuinely have this sense of camaraderie amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful to watch that, and know that that's kind of reflected the reality as well. And it's, that's one of the real pleasures of watching those three together, is that it's just that transcendent thing where it actually has that reality behind it. And you can feel that on the screen.
Alex, I can't thank you enough for making the film, for making the documentary, and for taking time to talk with me today about Last Breath. I really love the film. I love everything you put into bringing this story to life.
Thank you.
So well done. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, hopefully something soon, yeah. Hopefully.
I hope so. And I hope we get to talk about that in the future.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, and it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Alex. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. And that was Alex Parkinson talking about Last Breath. And as a reminder, Last Breath is in theaters and available on demand right now. Now we're going to shift gears, and it's time to hear from writer, director, and editor Brian Skiba talking about his new film, The Rootin' Tootin' Western Gunslingers, which will be out this coming Friday, April 11th, in theaters, on demand, and on digital. So no excuses to not see this film. And talk about a fun film. It's action-packed, lots of shootouts, there's a hanging. It's the Old West, you gotta have a hanging. A solid story with amazing cast, cinematic in scope thanks to widescreen scenes, and it's got Nicolas fucking Cage, people, in another one of his unique show-stopping and indelible roles. I always enjoy speaking with Brian, especially when it comes to Westerns, and he has outdone himself with Gunslingers. The story is one that embodies the spirit of the Old West and all those black hat versus white hat gunslinging films. And it boils down to when the most wanted man in America surfaces in a small Kentucky town, his violent history and a bloodthirsty mob seeking vengeance and a king's ransom soon follow. That doesn't bode well for the town, as you can imagine. At the heart of everything is a battle old as time, a battle between brothers, as brothers Thomas and Robert face off against one another, and bullets tear the town to shreds. And this lightning-fast gunslinger makes his enemies pay the ultimate price for their greed. However, we have so many gunslingers here. You're going to have to see the film to find out exactly which gunslinger is making enemies pay, because everybody here has enemies. As I said, written and directed and edited by Brian Skiba, Gunslingers boasts an all-star cast that includes Stephen Dorff, Heather Graham, Nicolas Cage, Randall Batenkoff, Cooper Barnes, Zima, Jeremy Kent Jackson, Costas Mandalore, Scarlett Stallone, William McNamara, our Yellowstone connection, Forey J. Smith, and Eric Mabius. Those of you that know Brian's work, you know that for his film Dead Man's Hand, he tapped the Yellowstone well with Cole Hauser and Mo Brings Plenty. So he's gone back to that authentic well again with real-life cowboy and rodeo champion, Forey J. Smith. Now, as we get into the interview, as you're going to hear, Brian talks about the development of the film, casting Stephen Dorff in the good guy role, which is a surprise move, working with Randall Batenkoff again, who is not only in the film, but also serves as a producer with his new distribution finance company. So this is very exciting for Randall. Diving into the physical production process, Brian discusses the visual grammar inspired by classic Westerns and his collaboration with his cinematographer, Patrice Lucien Cochet. And wait to hear the story about the editing process, which ultimately found Brian editing the film himself, and which should have been the plan all along, quite honestly. And we don't overlook Richard Patrick's score, which was developed over 6 weeks, which only adds to the success of this film. So take a listen to my exclusive interview with writer, director, editor Brian Skiba talking Gunslingers. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm so happy to be speaking with you yet again about another rootin' tootin' Western.
Thanks for having me on.
I am, oh my God. The minute I saw that Gunslingers was coming out, I knew I had to see it and I had to speak with you about it. As much as I loved what you did with Dead Man's Hand, this surpasses it. This is your action in this one. Your casting is just off the wall. I love your editing. It's crisp. It's sharp. Everything about this, Brian, it is, I think, one of your all-time best films.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Because this one you wrote, directed, unlike, you know, some of your others that you didn't write. Now here you wrote, directed, and you cut this one. Where did the idea for this particular story come, and what led to you reteaming with Dorf and Battenkopf?
So, you know, the story has been one that I've been working with an executive at Lionsgate, Barry Brooker. And he and I, after Dead Man's Hand, he said, you know, bring me another Western. I was also working with Alan Don Burstein on it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, between the four of us, we kind of all, you know, brainstorm on some things. We watched some older Westerns that aren't nearly as known, and worked on some thematic elements, you know. And I was like, I really want to tell a story of a bad guy who's trying to find peace, you know, and kind of follow that Unforgiven, you know, format,
mm-hmm.
kind of idea. Somebody, you know, and so, you know, this development process took, I think, 8 months to a year to get the script done. And then at that point, you know, I had done a couple more films with Dorf,
mm-hmm.
And then Randall and I had been working on, you know, The Trouble with Billy, a TV show. And so I sent it to Dorf first, and Dorf was like, yeah, I'm in, I want to play the lead, you know. And initially I think I'd offered him the bad guy, you know, and he's like, no, I want the lead. And which was awesome. I was like, man, I want you playing the lead. So, he took the lead, and then, you know, and then Randall came in and said, I'm starting a new distribution finance company, and we'd like this to be one of our first projects. And so Randall came on board in that aspect, and I think, you know, Randall is a phenomenal actor, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, so it was great to have his involvement from the start, and
I adore Randall. We've known each other going back to his days when he did the TV series Christie. And same thing with Dorf. Have known each other off and on over the decades. But your casting here is exemplary. And it thrilled me to see Dorf step into the role of Thomas. I personally would have thought him for Robert. But no, to see him as Thomas and seeking redemption and all, he really knocks it out of the park. But then you populate, and I am so tickled that Randall is stepping into producing with this new venture he's got going, because he's got such a wealth of knowledge and experience. But then you bring in Heather Graham, you've got Costas Mandalore, Scarlett Stallone. I didn't know what to expect. Beyond impressive, Brian. William McNamara, who you never know what you're going to get with him. He can play good, he can play bad. He can do both sides of the coin at the same time. And of course, you keep your Yellowstone connection going, bringing Forey in. And then the icing on the cake is Nick Cage. How did you score Nick Cage for this one?
It's a long story. We were lucky. I mean, we were extremely lucky. I have to admit, I was a bit of an unbeliever. You know, Randall and I had talked about it, and Randall's like, well, I'm going to make a call and see if Nylon, who's his manager or agent, I don't know, I'm going to talk to Nylon and see if Nick is available. And you know, and I was like, okay, I mean, you bring Nick Cage, man, this is awesome. And so he made a phone call, and sure enough, Cage was available and wanted to read the script. We sent over a short one page, and they came back and said, Cage wants to read the script. He loves Westerns. And so we sent over the script, and Cage really identified with Ben. We had offered him actually Costas's role first.
Mm-hmm. As Jericho, yeah.
Yeah, Jericho. And then Cage came back and said, no, I like the complexities of Ben. And that was that, you know. So it's, I think it was a mixture of just timing and you know, yeah.
Wow. Who came up with the voice that Cage is using? He did?
Nick and I, the morning of shooting, we had set all the lines, we had everything set, the look, he was dressed, he was sitting there, and he looks at me, and we were just talking, and he looks at me, and he's like, Brian, I feel like I need to do something with my voice. And I was like, oh, okay, what do you think? And so he started pitching me these different voices. And he did that one, and I was like, I like that one. I said, that one sounds like, you know, like you've been hung before. And then we talked backstory, and we were like, okay, so if you've been hung before, it was God that saved you from the hanging, and that's why you turned to Jesus, and you know, Bob's your uncle. So that's really how the voice came to fruition.
Oh,
so
my God.
It was just, you know, with Nick, it's a masterclass in character development,
yeah.
And he's just always, like, working and refining his characters, and I think that was really the cherry, you know, that was the cherry that he put on that character.
And then somewhere, you and your costume designer find those glasses for him. Which, that just, that blew my mind when I saw those, Brian. Nothing could have been more perfect.
Yeah, we didn't find those. Nick and I, we spent 2 weeks just, like, really working on this character, refining everything, because he really wanted Ben to be memorable. And he came to me, and he's like, I feel like I should have some eyewear. And so we started looking at different styles of sunglasses, and we found online there was like these cross sunglasses, and he was like, those, I want something like that. But these were like modern, you know, they're very modern plastic. So
mm-hmm.
I actually had to have these like custom made.
Wow.
So we had multiple pairs custom made, and Nick has a pair, I have a pair, and somebody else has the third pair. But they were custom, and I agree. I think it fits his character swimmingly. So
every penny you spent on them is well worth it. Trust me. Now, you know, you build this script up, you pace this really, really well, Brian, in terms of giving us action. You hit us with a bang at the start. We start getting into the story, into Thomas's story, and what happens there. And you keep feeding us, but the same time you're feeding us story, you're feeding us different kinds of action until everything comes to a climax in that third act. And you're working with Patrick again as your cinematographer. You worked with him on what, Out of Hand, I think?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The tree.
So you've got this great cinematography. Your visual grammar is stunning. So I'm curious about your work with Patrice and coming up with the visual grammar you have as you're going from wider frame into closer frames and leading up to the culmination of that third act shootout. And particularly, I got to say it, Cage's incredible pick up the gun scene. So what were your conversations like with Patrice? What were you looking for in developing this visual grammar for this film? Because it is different from what you did in Dead Man's Hand, what you did in Guns of Redemption.
Yeah, so I definitely wanted this film to have a more classic, kind of Unforgiven, Sergio Leone, kind of classic Western feel, I think. After Dead Man's Hand released, the stunt coordinator of Dead Man's Hand came to me and was like, hey, man, I enjoyed the film, but he's like, I've been in Westerns for 50 years, and he's like, you know, us Western fans, we want to see, you know, Sergio Leone type films. We want to see things that are, you know, that feed the genre, and the very genre specific, and that genre is shot a certain way, the action's done a certain way, those type things. So when we came to Gunslingers, I told Patrice, you know, I want this film to be an homage to the films of the 70s, 80s, 90s, of, you know, an homage, at least in the style, you know. So it's going to be dolly moves, it's going to be, you know, it's not Michael Bay, we're not doing shaky cam, you know, and I did that in Guns and Redemption just so I could set them apart, you know. Mm-hmm. This film was definitely a very classically filmed movie, you know, that was the idea, is try to keep it as classic as possible, and then the action was designed by 5150, you know, one of the best stunt groups in LA. Mike Gunther and his team did a phenomenal job. So, you know, and still feeding that classic feel, and so that's what was important to me. And the cinematography was having a classic. Classic Western type feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lighting and lensing is spectacular, Brian. I'm really drawn to, number one, the contrast between the battles out on the showdown out on the street versus the interiors. And in the cave sequence, you really create a different feel. And I do love the camera movement that you have going. There's a fluidity, but it's also very cinematic and very classic. When I said this, I think is one of the best films that you've ever done. This is one of the reasons why. How challenging was the editing on this one, Brian? To keep this pace and to keep the story going without doing an overload of action or having too much action and not enough story so we care about these characters.
Process, you know, we had another editor come in for a little bit and put together an assembly, and unfortunately when you know, some of the execs at Lionsgate saw that assembly, they called me and said, why aren't you editing this movie? You know, they know that I typically edit my films, and they weren't happy that I wasn't editing this one, you know. And so they said, so they said, you know, please edit the movie. And so I had to take it in and really start refining. And it was a refining process, and it took 3 months. It was not an easy film to edit. We had three cameras going all the time, minimum of three cameras. We had time those a lot more. And getting that flow down was difficult, you know, because the initial cut had some more flashbacks in it, and it was a lot of, like, you know, get the cut done, watch, get notes from people that I trust, and then go back in and refine. You know, I really put my heart and soul into this edit and trying to refine it as much as I could.
The pacing is fantastic on this one. And I'm so glad Lionsgate chastised you. Because, yes, you must edit your own films, Brian. No one understands your films better than you do. And there aren't a lot of filmmakers that I can say that about. So, yeah, you need to edit your films because you know what's in your head as to what you want as you're shooting and you're running and you're gunning. So I'm glad that Lionsgate chastised you. Now, I have to ask you about the score in this one, Richard Patrick's score. I like this score. What were you looking for musically?
Exactly what Richard did. I mean, Richard and I were, you know, again, you know, it's... When we got to the process of scoring the film, you know, I went and sat with Richard for 2 weeks. I mean, I was in the studio, you know, for about 2 weeks, and we really, like, worked together hand in hand on this score, and You know, and I'd go in for like 2-3 days. I mean, 2 weeks, like over a period of 6 weeks, as I was actually in there, and so I'd go in for like 2-3 days. He'd lay some tracks, he'd play me some tracks that he already laid, we'd make some tweaks, and then I'd go and he'd do some more work, and then I'd come back and we'd listen to it and we talk about every, you know, the themes and stuff like that. But the thing about Richard is he's like one of the most talented musicians, songwriters, you know, and just a phenomenal guy, and so you know, and so creative, and he's got a style and a vibe, and that's something you don't get with a lot of just standard score guys. A lot of standard mm-hmm. score guys will go in and just go online and find samples and stuff like that, and lay in major chords in a orchestra, and that's all you get. Whereas with Patrick, it there's a soul to it, you know, and mm-hmm. it's very much Filter. It's very much his own, you know, it's his soul. It's people who are fans of Filter, Nine Inch Nails, Richard Patrick, you know, those people will definitely identify with the score. So
everything is just wonderful with this one, Brian. They're texting me, we have to wrap, but I want another Western from you. I want another one, Brian, please.
I was just offered to direct a movie about Dodge, Get Out of Dodge.
Oh.
We'll see if it comes together, but
it'll be fun. You just have such a knack with Westerns, and to put together a cast like this. You had a great cast with Dead Man's Hand, this cast, and nabbing Nick Cage with such a unique character and a great hanging sequence. So just on every level, Brian, absolutely wonderful. I can't praise you enough about this one. Thank you for taking time to speak with me about this one, and hopefully I'll get you on the next one too.
All right, deal. Let's do it.
Thanks so much, Brian. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too. And as I said, Gunslingers releases this Friday, April 11th, in theaters, on demand, and on digital. Last Breath, you can see on demand and in theaters right now as well. So that is all the time we have today. Join me again next week when I talk with the filmmakers for the new comedy, Relative Control. And trust me, it is hilarious. When you have relatives, fighting siblings, parental favorites, and aging parents. And we get into a comedic look at a very serious theme that involves taking care of your elders, nursing homes, assisted living, wills, disposition of property. But it all comes together with heart, humor, and hilarity. So I can't wait for you to join me next week when I talk about that film with the filmmakers. But until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.